Good morning, everyone. Today is January the 23rd. It's 9 a.m. We're in the State Capitol Building. This is the first Senate Finance Committee of the year. So we're going to go through introductions. First of all, joined by Co-Chairman Stedman, Senator Olson is excused, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Cronk, and Senator Kaufman. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. We're going to go through some protocols and decorum first for the committee for the year. Speaking of the mic, it's the official record, and we are broadcasting to the public as well. Note passing is limited to members at their finance aides only. The committee pages will deliver all notes. The co-chairman requests members of the staff to refrain from eating, reading iPads, newspapers, magazines are not permitted to the meeting or communication via cell phone, so please turn all of those off. A memo to the co-chairman from the co-chairman regarding decorum in further detail will be sent to Senate offices. So again, welcome. At this time, we're going to start by having introductions of your staff. My staff, we have Chief of Staff Tim Grusendorf. Pete Eklund is Operating Budget Coordinator. Mario Borio is the Legislative and Finance Aide. Additionally, I have Sam Greeley and Pat Walker on my team. I'll turn it over to Co-Chairman Stedman for his staff introductions, as well as those of Senator Olson, who is excused today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Returning to the Senate Finance Committee from my office is Dave Scott. He will be active in working with Senator Hoffman and Olson on scheduling, and he's the capital budget coordinator. So all your capital requests will be reviewed by him. We also have Rose Foley. She's financial aide in the office. She's been here since she was just a young lady right out of college. We won't say how many years that was, but when I first showed up, she was here shortly thereafter. Margo Youngberg, she's starting her second year in my office. Is that correct? Third year?
Second year.
Fourth year. She's been here a while.
Time flies.
She's been here a while. She's getting the hang of it. The boss is a little bit behind. And she's going to work with legislation, not only legislation that comes here at the table, also in assistance to Ms. Foley, but she's going to work on the Transportation Committee aides. So if committee members have questions down from the Transportation Committee, if they're curious what's going on, they can chat with her. Barbara Schneider is new to my office. She's been here a couple of years in the other body. She's decided that she likes to have her evenings off and would like to work in the Senate, so we took care of that. So that is our team. And now for Senator Olson, Liz Harpold will be the finance bill coordinator. Where is she at? She's over here. Okay, so all of the legislation will channel through her, and she'll do her magic. The chief of staff stays the same, Senator Olson's office. Kelly Good, is she in the room? Kelly? Well, she's down the hall if she's not in the room. And Elmira Alcantara will be a staff aide, legislative staff aide. She may not be in the room also. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it back over to you for the next series of introductions.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Senator Keel, can you introduce your staff to the committee and to the general public?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. With me, behind me at the table is Kathy Schlingheide. Like Ms. Youngberg, the time goes by very quickly. However, I took notes, and she is starting her seventh year, laboring under the heavy yoke of my office. So please be kind to her. She suffers enough. On my staff as well, although not in the room today, are Aurora Hawk, Ella Adkison, and our University of Alaska Ted Stevens Foundation intern, Cole Osuski. So it's a strong team, and I look forward to working with all of you and yours.
Thank you very much. Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Coach, Mr. Co-Chair. I am pleased to report that we have the same stellar staff in the Merrick office this year. My Chief of Staff and Finance Aide is Ms. Jamie Jones behind me. And in the gallery, my staff, Sorsha Hazelton, will be the Committee Aide for Community and Regional Affairs, as well as my community and as well as my staff for Labor and Commerce. And Carrie Crocker is going to be running legislation for me and doing my scheduling. So we're looking forward to a great year in here in finance. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Senator Kelly Merrick. Senator Mike Gronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My staff behind me, finance staff, is Sue Stancliffe. I will not tell you how long she's been a staff member in this building, because I really don't know. It's been a long time. I also have Paul Menke working in my office, and Dave Stancliffe is taking care of things back home right now. So that's who we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cronk. Senator Kaufman, welcome to the committee for both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Helping me here in finance is Dominic Harnett. He'll be focusing on the budget with me. Emma Torkelson, my chief of staff, she's also been with me for a few years. She'll be helping with the capital budget when that time comes. And not in the room, our front desk and office manager is Takuma Inoue. He's new this year, new to the Capitol, and a sharp young man, so be sure and drop in and say hi to him. And thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to inform the committee that this is probably going to be one of the most difficult financial decision-making eras that this committee has seen in recent times. So be prepared to roll up your sleeves and lots of hard work ahead of us. With that, I'd like to introduce the Finance Committee secretaries. First is Denise Donnie Gott, who's been a longtime member. She's sitting back to the in front of the doors. Allison Wade is right there. We have Marta Lastufka behind me. How are they doing, pronunciation? Thank you. And Lori Hosey. Final person. And the LIO moderator is David Moore. So that concludes all of the introductions. Are there any additional comments that any members want to make regarding this upcoming session here today? Seeing none, looking forward to working with you and all of your staff to accomplish what we at the committee are here to do, is take care of the finance decisions, recommendations to our caucus. Today's agenda, we have the production forecast from the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Commissioner, can you come forward, please, and any lifelines you want, please proceed. We have Commissioner John Boyle, and you might want to introduce your working team on this most important department.
Yes. Yes, thank you, and good morning, Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, and honorable members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, this is John Boyle. I am the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and it's our pleasure to be in front of you this morning. Joining me at the table is Travis Peltier, one of our commercial analysts within the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, and our division director, Derek Nottingham, is also with us. And behind me, of course, I've got John Crowther, my deputy commissioner, who may be a lifeline if the questions get too tough, my special assistant, Rena Miller, and then lastly, my legislative liaison, Joe Burns, who many of you may know. Tomorrow is Joe's last day, and maybe if the co-chair will indulge me, just want to take an opportunity to thank him for his service, both in this body, as you know, I know most of you have had an opportunity to work with Joe, and also just his service to DNR, which has been invaluable over the past 2 years. So we're sorry to see him go, but you know, wish him all the best as he goes to serve the state's interest in the halls of the Capitol in the Washington, D.C. So, And for any other legislative staffers that may be laboring under the yoke of certain offices, you know, we do have an opening. And
that's a little bit uncalled for.
Anyway, well, thank you, Co-Chair. We're pleased to be here today. We certainly understand the import of this session. There's going to be a lot of tough decisions. I'm sure they're going to have to be made. For our part, we're doing our best to help, at least by continuing to promote the development of the state's natural resources. And I think the presentation that we have today is reflective of an overall good news story. If we look back to where we thought we would be today, 10 years ago, I think the future looked pretty bleak. As I reviewed kind of our production forecasts from the decade ago, you know, our anticipation today is that we'd be somewhere in the 300,000 barrel a day range of production. And, you know, for as tight as things are today, you could only imagine where things would be if we'd actually kind of hit that target. You know, fortunately, we've avoided that future. You know, what we've seen is continued strong investment into the state's legacy oil fields. And in those efforts, those investments have helped to sustain the level of production that we've seen over the past few years. And I think we're just under 500,000 barrels a day of production. And so we start off, I guess, from a point that is better than where we forecasted. And as we now pivot to looking ahead, you may recall from last year's presentation, our forecast now shows a significant increase in state production as we look out at that 10-year horizon. And what has changed from today is that a lot of those projects that we've looked at prospectively, those projects that have been under evaluation or in some form of development, you know, that wedge is now starting to slide forward. And so as the future becomes closer to the present, what we anticipate seeing, of course, is that new production coming online. I think our top line number increases somewhat to just over 650,000 barrels a day, kind of in the end of that 10-year window. And of course, you know, we continue to see the progression of a number of major projects, of course, that are going to be driving that. And really, I think the significance for the people of the state is that I think today, as we look at what PICA is going to mean to the state, as we look at what Willow is going to mean to the state and some of these other developments, it's as if we're just before the period of time when Kuparuk came into production. I mean, we're talking about that much production, that much potential, that much investment that's coming to the state. And so brighter days are ahead of us, and we're certainly optimistic about what we're seeing. Part of the good news story that I'd like to highlight is that, again, we've seen critical investments in a lot of our legacy fields, and Milne Point is a phenomenal example of where, you know, that field was in significant decline, and thanks to Hilcorp's stewardship of that particular asset, you know, we're seeing major increases of production there. Many of you may know that Hilcorp has recently acquired interest in the Aguruk and Nakayachuk fields. You know, our expectation and hope is to continue to see that investment into those fields as well, and we think, you know, there's a high likelihood that Hilcorp will be able to take those assets and do for them as they've done for Milne Point, which, again, these investments into the backbone of our current and existing production are going to be essential, again, to not only maintaining production to where we're at, but helping us to see those significant increases as new fields come online. And lastly, I'll just point out, the other thing that we're seeing is robust interest in the state's lease sale offerings on the North Slope. We had a successful lease sale this fall. And as we look around, the state has created a number of new units. We have a number of explorers that are currently out exploring areas on the on the, both the west and the east on the North Slope, and so we fully anticipate continued good news stories. I hope that in the next few years we're going to be coming back and we're going to watch that under evaluation wedge continue to grow, because we've, you know, from what I understand from talking to some of these folks, there's a lot of potential. We know the rocks are good, and I think with the recent change in federal administration and the clarity that that is going to provide around certain regulatory regimes on some of the federally managed areas in the state, I fully anticipate seeing increased investment, increased interest in Alaska, and a bright future for the state. So with that, I'll pause, and if there's any questions for me, I'm happy to take them. If not, we'll allow my team to kick us off.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge that we've been joined by two other legislators. They've been here since the beginning, Senator Geisel and Representative Klom. Welcome to the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Geisel has been a fixture over the many years in this committee. Could you expand a little bit on what you anticipate the effect of having Trump highlighting energy as a national issue and how that might affect Alaska?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Hoffman. As many of you have seen, the President's first night, he issued a number of executive orders, both specifically relating to Alaska and also relating to energy in general. You know, the President has declared an energy emergency. Of course, you know, we're going to see what that means in effect. But I think, you know, our expectation is that there's going to be renewed interest in streamlining the permitting processes, ensuring that instead of us taking us 10 or 15 years to see some of these new developments come online, you know, if we can truncate that window somewhat to get these new projects moving more quickly, I think that's going to be a significant improvement and an incentivizer to companies that are looking to invest their money. And I just recently returned from a trip with the governor overseas, talking to some international investors. They're very interested and bullish on investing in the United States, particularly as you kind of look at what the investment landscape across the world looks like. But the number one issue that we continue to hear is it's, you know, permitting timelines and uncertainty, litigation. You know, those types of issues are the kind of the dampeners in terms of really people opening the checkbooks and wanting to push a lot of new projects forward. So I think, you know, with President Trump's focus on those key areas, I would fully anticipate seeing increased interest as folks look at Alaska as a potential investment destination.
And the final question that I have is that we all know and understand that the rail belt anchorage in Fairbanks are heavily dependent upon gas, and that there's a lot of concern about where we're going with gas. I think we're seeing something that happened 10 years ago where we entered a short-term solution, and I, for one, am more interested in a long-term solution on gas. And what do you see there, not only from the governor, but from what's happening in Washington?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Hoffman. I think a couple of things. One, excuse me, we know that gas exists in the Cook Inlet, I guess from a geologic standpoint. We know that there's resource there, and we know particularly that there's well-defined and delineated resource in a few areas. So our focus, of course, is one, doing whatever we can do to help incentivize continued investment in the Cook Inlet. We understand that the economics for some of these projects can be challenging. You know, the state's approach, as some of you may recall last year, was to bring forward some proposals that would have adjusted the state's royalty take on Cook Inlet gas in particular, and oil, I should say, to help incentivize that. The state has taken administrative steps in terms of granting royalty relief for companies that have requested it and have gone through our administrative process for that, which is ongoing. I would say we're also taking a very hard look at the other mechanisms that the state has with our management of the existing leases and units that are out there. You know, we've made it very clear to the operators of some of these areas that unless certain benchmarks are made, unless wells are drilled and activity takes place, you know, the state is moving forward, if we have to pull those leases back or shrink those units down and to get them back out into the market as expeditiously as possible so that we can, again, hopefully draw those companies that have the capital and the wherewithal to get those resources into production as soon as possible. I fully expect we'll be having more conversations with the legislature around overall policy as it relates to that. And then, you know, lastly, I'll say on the federal side, again, if we have a federal administration that is committed to working with the state, is committed to helping to improve the state's energy security, I would think that that will help improve the regulatory environment and interest that companies may have in looking at federal OCS leasing in the Cook Inlet, which, again, could provide a little longer runway for the state as we continue to rely on gas for the majority of our energy needs and provide more of that bridge as we work towards progressing the Alaska LNG pipeline and look to other energy resources to fill the gap.
Thank you for those comments. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you and good morning. For the record, my name is Travis Peltier. I'm a petroleum reservoir engineer in the resource evaluation section of the Division of Oil and Gas within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. In 2006, I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks with a master's in mechanical engineering and have spent 18 years in Alaska's oil industry, predominantly working on the North Slope as a petroleum engineer for BP. In my 14 years with that company, I worked all the fields BP owned or operated from the Kuparuk River Unit in the west to Point Thompson Unit in the east. And in 2021, I joined the Department of Natural Resources in my current position as a petroleum reservoir engineer. And I'm honored to continue leading the development of the state of Alaska's oil production forecast this year. Today, we will be talking about Alaska's oil production forecast for the next decade. For your awareness, the department has been performing this analysis since 2016. The goal for today is to share the results of fiscal year 2024 and to share the oil production forecast for the next 10 years, including methodology and background on how this is generated. All right. So when we start on our presentation here, we will have on slide 2 and then in the appendix a couple of reference slides. I'm not going to speak to acronyms. I'm going to try to not use them during my presentation, so this is included for your awareness only for anyone who wants to refer back to that. As well as in the appendix, we do have a table of property, or I should say royalty by land type, both in a tabular form and then a map. Again, we won't be referring to those specifically unless questions come up, but I wanted you to be aware of that for your awareness as well. So I'm going to move on then to the agenda for today's presentation.
While you're going through, just take a minor pause at the end of each slide to see if we have questions from members. Please proceed.
So for today's presentation, we've already done some introductions, and we're going to start off with a preview of the forecast that was generated in the fall of 2024. After that, we'll transition to how did we do with fiscal year 2024 specifically, as originally predicted in the fall of 2023. When we're done with that, we'll transition then to the fall of 2024 production forecasting and approach, and then discuss the forecast results in summary from this forecasting effort that was recently completed. And then again, we do have, if any questions come up in the appendix, we can share them then. All right, thank you. So again, just a preview and to orient everyone to what we're seeing on this chart. This is the fall 2024 forecast for the North Slope. This chart is the same table of data that was published in the Fall 2024 Department of Revenue Sources book, simply in chart form. What we have on this, on the axis on the left, is your fiscal year annual average daily oil production. So again, this is an annual average, but the rates are daily, so for a whole year. The scale on the left goes from 0 to 1 million barrels of oil per day. And on the x-axis, we have fiscal years plotted, so there's 10 of them, from 2025 on the left all the way to 2034 on the right. The data that is included in this chart, we have three pieces of data that are created by, you know, the Department of Natural Resources, published by the Department of Revenue. That's the official forecast, the solid blue line chart in the middle, along with a high and a low. I'll talk about those more in a second. Then we have the fourth line chart on there is the operator data. So going back to the official forecast, that's what we expect, you know, to be the forecast number. That's what we're going to refer back to for most of our numbers. However, within that, there's a range of uncertainty. So each year, you know, we end up spending a lot of time looking at how our previous years have done, future projects, and there's a lot of uncertainty in any development. And so each year we like to have an understanding of, like, what could production be on a high side and a low side case. And as time goes by, that uncertainty increases. That's why you see a low side and a high side diverging through time. The other chart in here is the operator chart. So during the forecasting process, we do have a lot of confidential discussions with operators. The ones who are operating currently producing fields do provide us with their expectations of what their fields are going to make. We summarize all of those across the North Slope and plot them here simply as the operator chart. And that's just a reference for us to see how in alignment we are with our current, you know, operators on the North Slope. Again, one thing I'm going to point out for fiscal year 2025, between the low and the high side case versus the official forecast, that basically represents plus or minus 5%. And you can see the operator forecast and our forecast, you know, while there is a difference, they're still within that, you know, plus or minus 5% window.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They end up within that band, but there seems to be a significant difference in the directions of the trend lines between DNR's projections and the operators. Why are we so optimistic and they less so?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. One thing to point out, so the operator chart is simply data from currently producing fields. So projects like PICA that are not currently producing, we do not get an operator forecast from them. That is not included in the operator data. So that's why you see, you know, there's a slight increase and then a decline through time. The large projects that we see coming on, including Willow, we don't get a production forecast for Willow as well, included in the operator forecast. Those are not included as compared to in the official forecast. We do include those in the fullness of time.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to keep a wary eye. The commissioner talked about 10 years ago what the forecast was. I remember 12 years ago, folks at this table were told if we just cut oil taxes, we'd be at 1 million barrels a day just off state land by now. I'll just point to the left-hand side of this chart for how close that was.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, just a quick one on this chart on the previous answer. It's a little, I guess, well, it'd be nice if there was a disclosure at the bottom pointing out the issue that Senator Keel brought up, his first issue, not the second one, on comparison between the high and the low, just for clarity. But with that, it gets confusing because we got the revenue department that deals with severance tax and property tax and other things, and then we've got you guys over at DNR that deal with royalties. So when I look at this chart, is the whole royalties the same? And I can, because we're the money committee, right? We can't sell a barrel of oil. We deal in cash. After certain cash, so is the royalties for the finance committee to deal with going to trend along that official forecast, if the official forecast is correct, or is there a difference in location of production and the royalties that you can actually put on the table for us to discuss? Can you help me with that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Sedman. When we provide the forecast to the Department of Revenue, they are aware of where the locations are, the royalty rates for the various units, the various fields, and the various future projects, and that gets built into the Department of Revenue revenue sources book.
Senator Sedman.
That doesn't answer the question. I know that they do that, but you guys, we have to deal with the royalty questions to your department. And here we're seeing oil production, which is going to include royalties. It appears that we're going to be at our minimum tax and severance going forward for the foreseeable future, almost. And we'll get into that in a couple of days. So when we just isolate royalties, what is the royalty generation that is going to be created under your forecast? Because there is a difference between what royalties are collected to the state on different land ownerships. That's the point I want you to explain to the public. I tried to ask it a little more tactfully, but explain to the public that issue, because that's what the meeting's here about, is for the public.
Mr. Peltier.
For the record, I'm Derek Nottingham. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I don't know that we have a chart that can explicitly explain the question you're asking, Stedman. But if we turn to the appendix, there's a table in the appendix that we can walk through that we can explain the different royalties for the different kind of regimes that we're talking about North Slope production from, if the committee wants us to kind of walk through that table.
Understood.
You could touch on it. I know it's in the packet, but maybe you can get back to the committee on that bifurcation of location and generation, because royalties, it appears, are going to be very significant to the state going forward with when we're down on the minimum tax. And I think we need to keep an eye on and understand that all oil is not equal, because there's different land ownerships and different tax scenarios. And it's hard for us here, because we've got to deal with one department that deals with royalties, the other department to deal with the, you know, the other taxes. And if you don't ask the right department the question, you don't get the answer.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
For the record, Travis Peltier. So we're going to transition now to the fiscal year 2024 in review. So on this chart, it's simply a question of, in fiscal year 2024, how did we do as originally forecasted in the fall of 2023? I think we've talked about this slightly on the previous chart. We do have a forecast range, and I will speak to the chart on the right here for a moment. The chart on the right is fiscal year annual average daily oil production. Scale is 0 to 600,000 barrels a day per year. This is just for fiscal year 2024 as a snapshot. Again, part of the Department of Revenue sources book, on the high side case, you know, the plus or minus 5%, the high side expectation was around 519,000 barrels of oil per day. I'll be rounding here. And then on the low side case, we had about 422,000 barrels of oil per day, with the Department of Revenue sources book official forecast target around 470,000 barrels of oil per day. Actual production came in at around 461,000 barrels of oil per day. That means our forecast was about 2% higher than the actual production was for fiscal year of 2024. Again, just for a frame of reference, the operator summation from the fall of 2023 was 468,000 barrels and change. So both the operators and ourselves forecasted higher. Within that 2% number, of course, we like to know, what did we do wrong? How did things change throughout the year? And there was three major components that we took a look at that kind of got to that 2% number. One of them, we actually found a calculation error in our methodology, and we've fixed that. That accounted for roughly 1% of that 2% number. So that's been addressed for this upcoming forecast we will talk about, and it will be corrected, of course, for all future forecasts. For all previous forecasts, we're not going to change that calculation error, so it will still be reflected in any prior forecast that you see from the spring of 2024 and earlier. But starting in fall 2024, and later it will have been fixed. In addition, part of the other 2%, we had a couple of items that came up last year that didn't meet our expectations. One was that there was a sales line that froze from the Point Thompson unit. We did not anticipate that would be occurring. It happened in mid-January. We thought maybe after talking to the operator initially, it would get resolved quickly, but it turned out to be an ice plug in the sales line, and so it had to wait until late May for that to resolve. And so that drop in production from Point Thompson was not anticipated. Along with that, we had expectations on the number of wells to be drilled on the North Slope, and that expectation was also not met. So those factors combined, the calculation error, the frozen sales line, the under-delivery on drilling count versus our expectations, to that 2% number forecast being higher than actual production. Some things on the horizon, and Commissioner Boyle has already discussed this a little bit in his introductory remarks, to keep in mind when we take a look at the future. You know, industry interest in the Brookian Age plays, what we also call the Nanushik, continues across the North Slope, you know, with exploration, with development production, development projects being constructed. There still continues to be a lot of industry interest in the Nanushik, which I think is a good thing going forward. And one thing on this slide, you know, when we published this was last week, the recent federal regulatory and leasing restrictions at the time do present challenges. It may materially change with the new administration. I think Commissioner Boyle, again, hit on that during some of his introductory remarks. And then one other item that we've heard a lot across various operators on the slope is that equipment constraints as Pikka and Willow ramp up and overall inflation are affecting North Slope exploration, project costs, and operations. So that is also a factor right now on the North Slope.
Please proceed.
Something new that we wanted to put into the production forecast this year was how can we reference how our forecast is on a monthly basis when we come to this committee versus how production is actually forecasted. So we put this together for fiscal year of 2024. What we have on this chart is oil production rate on the left, again, from 0 to 600,000 barrels. That corresponds to the two line charts on the towards the top of this graph. You have the blue line, which is our monthly forecast, again, as generated in the fall of 2023. Overlaid against that is actual pipeline North Slope data at a daily rate published for the entire fiscal year. The bottom two lines are cumulative production. So the dashed blue line, which is mostly covered up by the orange, is the cumulative forecast value. And then overlaid with that is the cumulative actual production that we see throughout the year. Along with that, part of the line on the very top under the title, fiscal year 2024, does include the calculation that shows that our forecast, actual production was only 98.1% of our forecast. That corresponds to the 2% on the previous slide. What you can see here on this slide with the daily line chart is in mid-January, there is a slight production drop, as you do see Point Thompson sales line freezing. And then you also see, again, we discussed our expectation of drilling. As you drill more throughout the year, you know, that wedge grows and grows. And so earlier on in time, you don't necessarily see it, but as we get towards the end of this yearly forecast, you do kind of see that wedge, the difference between our forecast of production and actual production widen as well.
Please proceed.
All right. So let's talk specifically about the North Slope now for fiscal year 2024. Just a generality here to start with. You know, when you have an existing oil production field, you expect to see production decline year after year after you hit peak rate. The North Slope fields have been in production, the major ones anyways, for decades. So it's something we would expect to see. You know, even with continued investment, even with continued drilling, you generally expect to see production decline year on year. With that being said, I'm going to move over to the top chart on the right, the one titled North Slope Daily Production. The fiscal year annual average daily production rate, again, is a daily rate for the whole year, going from 0 to 600,000 barrels per day. We have that from fiscal years 2018 all the way through 2024. And you can kind of see that general decline from 518,000 barrels per day, again, rounding here in 2018, declining down to just about 461,000 barrels per day in 2024, with the slight variations, of course, year on year. If you compare fiscal year 2023 to fiscal year 2024, North Slope production did decrease by about 4%, or 18,700 barrels of oil per day. We have on the chart on the bottom where those decreases came from. The bullet points correspond to the chart, so I'm actually going to use the chart as a reference, but my discussion points should match the bullet points as well. When you take a look at production changes across the North Slope, and you take a look at the chart, again, it starts at zero, and this one drops down to 25,000 barrels per day on the y-axis. And you take a look at the Colville River units, the Endicott unit, the Kaparik River unit, those all experience natural decline within their reservoirs. However, with continued investment and continued drilling, that natural decline was offset a little bit, which is a good news story. And then you have Nikaichuk, North Star, and Agouric. Those are the three offshore oil fields you have in the middle of the chart again. Those experienced natural reservoir decline. There was no infill drilling during the time frame that we have production for this. And then we move over to the next two large decreases. One is for Prudhoe Bay and one is for Point Thompson. So just a reminder, Prudhoe Bay is a very large field. It produces, and I'm going to round here, about half of North Slope total production, so in excess of 200,000 barrels of oil per day. It's not unexpected to see 4 to 5% decline in a year, so you should be expecting somewhere in the 8 to 10,000 barrel a day decline rate each year. This was a relatively large year. Part of the reason for that was in fiscal year 2024, and actually in August of 2023, there was a turnaround in Prudhoe Bay that was relatively steep, and so that number for Prudhoe Bay is relatively large compared to what we've seen in previous years. For Point Thompson, we talked about this a little bit on the previous chart, but the sales line was frozen for most of the first half of 2024. And so that led to a relatively large decrease year on year for Point Thompson as well. The increases that we saw were out of Badami and the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit and then Milne Point. For Badami, there was a well that was worked over late in fiscal year 2023, B107. It's one of the unit's strongest well, and so we saw that production continue to flow into fiscal year 2024, leading to a field-wide increase. And then for the Greater Moose's Tooth, the GMT2 pad has seen continued development drilling from it. So again, year on year with continued development drilling, that unit has also seen increased production. And then Milne Point, which we also have another slide on that we'll show next. This field has actually had over the past, 8 years or 6 years, two large new pads developed on it. Back in 2018, they started up the Milne Point M pad. And then last year, we talked about what was once a future project, now is currently in production. Raven pad recently started up at Milne Point as well. So those continued developments, along with continued infill drilling at Milne Point, we've seen another continued increase this year of about 4,000 barrels per day out of the Milne Point unit.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peltier, can you help us with a term of art? Folks at home may not have a steep turnaround sounds like a pretty good thing. A turnaround artist gets failing companies to succeed. But a steep turnaround in a well sounds like, you said, led to steep, faster decline. Can you maybe just for the benefit of the public tell us why a steep turnaround is a bad thing?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I should say it's a maintenance activity. It's not really necessarily a bad thing. I'd view it as a good thing. When you perform a turnaround on a facility like in the North Slope in the summer months, the facilities on the slope, especially Prudhoe Bay, are particularly sensitive to temperature. It's harder for them to actually produce gas and reinject gas in the summer. So for them to do maintenance activities the summer months to make the most sense. Every year, then, the whole intent is to get the most production you can out of the winter months. So doing those maintenance activities, again, in the summer is the best time to do it. And it just so happens that the August 2023 maintenance activity that was performed led to what you see here. Again, there's no forecast here, right? This is just actual production changes year on year. Just helped lead to a relatively large apparent production decrease year on year out of the Prudhoe Bay field.
Senator Keel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
I need a little bit of help. Because it looks like when we look back in time over the production declines, you mentioned 4 or 5% or whatever number you use as the natural decline rate. You didn't use the word natural decline, but that's in essence what you told us of a field. And we have a Hillcorp, a relatively new entrance into the field that does not pay corporate income tax because they're not a C Corp. And that costs the state probably $100 to $150 million a year, some number, right? the argument that is presented quite a bit is, yes, there's a give up in revenue, but there's an offsetting increase in production. And we're trying to always grapple with that. How much in revenue set aside because we lost the corporate income tax at BP, the predecessor was paying versus their production increase. And clearly there's been a production change. That's pretty hard to argue it hasn't taken place. If you look back year on year, from the beginning of the fiscal year, we're up from last year about almost 1.5%. Go back 2 years, we're down 3.5%, which is negative. But that's a huge increase versus the decline of 8 or 10, the natural decline. So can you help us bifurcate out the marginal production increase that is taking place in the basin because of the new entrants? Because from just a casual view, and we don't have the data you have, we have to always use this amalgamated data set that has everybody in there. There's only three players, and we can't bifurcate it to actually know what's going on. But clearly we know Prudhoe Bay is the biggest field, and there's been a substantial turnaround in Prudhoe Bay, offsetting declines of other companies. So a fairly significant magnitude is taking place. So I guess I need help to see if it is truly offsetting the $100 to $150 million in foregone revenue, appears to, versus not. Can you help us with that? At least with the production, maybe if not the dollars.
Mr. Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Co-Chair Stedman. For the record, this is John Boyle, Commissioner. I'll kind of provide a rough overview, and then I'll let my team kind of fill in the details. The things that I would point to is, one, we have seen robust investment by the operator of the Prudhoe Bay field into, conducting a number of activities that we see as being conducive to continuing and maintaining production or at least stemming, as you point out, Co-Chair Stedman, that steeper kind of decline rate if the fields were, let's just say, in pure harvest mode. So, one, we do see that investment. Two, again, I think Milne Point is a great – In particular, it's a great indicator of what kind of Hilcorp's specialty is in terms of taking a field that, while operated by BP, was in basically harvest mode or steep decline, and through their investment, through their kind of innovative techniques to working that particular field. Again, we've seen a dramatic turnaround in the amount of production, coming from Milne Point. I mean, the fact that I don't know what the exact age of Milne Point is. My team can fill that in, but it's decades old, and the fact that right now it stands up is one field that has seen a significant increase year over year, I think is indicative of that investment by Hilcorp, and again, just emblematic of the fact that they are making investments in our legacy fields that are bringing tangible results. Lastly, I'll point out that the fact that they were interested and were the procurers of ENI's interests in Ugarit and Nikaichuk, again, is indicative of the fact that Hilcorp continues to invest on the North Slope, that they are picking up assets from operators that, I think ENI was a good operator, but clearly their Alaskan assets for them were not a high company priority. And so we were just basically seeing kind of continued decline in those fields, a lack of investment. With Hilcorp acquiring those assets, with the analogies that I think the rocks and under those fields have with, like, let's just say Milne Point, for example, our anticipation would be to see that the same level of investment, the same level of production increase from those fields. So, you know, as we contemplate changes in tax structure and the like, certainly that will influence company behavior to some extent. If companies are paying more in tax, then they may be inclined to invest less. Of course, it's, you know, obviously it's up to the committee to kind of decide where the right line is to draw. But I think from a DNR standpoint, you know, we do see that level of commitment, that level of investment, the kind of continued plans moving forward to doing more work in all of these legacy fields that to us indicate that this is an important asset to that company, that they will continue to invest more, and as a result, the state will see increased production that we may not have otherwise seen, assuming that the old operatorship had kind of continued and the same investment profile continued.
Senator Stedman?
No, just the tracking we do internally, there seems to be unexplained upward production, which takes capital investments that were, you know, can't be really predicted from past production. So something's going on up there that to the positive that we don't have the data here to, you know, when it's all commingled to separate. But it is significant because we've seen a substantial change in direction. Flat or almost horizontal is a heck of a lot better than a negative 4 or 5.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
For the record, Travis Peltier. Before I move on from this slide, one thing I did want to point out is the link on the bottom. During the past year, the AOGCC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which publishes every day production data from the North Slope and Cook Inlet fields, worked with us in the Division of Oil and Gas to create interactive charts that anyone can go and look at, you know, even if you have a smartphone, iPad, personal computer, so you can go and take a look at production chart data for the entire history of both the North Slope and the Cook Inlet down to the well level if you're interested. And that's available on that link there. So I'll
Thank
move
you
on.
For that.
Yep. So again, as we kind of previously talked about on the last slide, every year we come here and every year we talk about how Lonely Point's production continues to increase and increase and increase. So we thought it'd be worth taking a look at the entire production history of Lonely Point from the BP operatorship to the Hillcorp operatorship. There is some we did truncate off in the early 90s from the ConocoPhillips early operatorship before it transitioned to BP. But we thought this was kind of the most relevant information. So when we take a look at this chart, again, I'm going to orient folks to what the line axes are before I talk about the data that's in the chart. We have daily oil production rates on the left. That axis goes from 0 to 60,000 barrels of oil per day. Water daily production rates on the right. That goes from 0 to roughly 150,000 on the right that you can see. The top of the axis is actually 200,000. And then what we have plotted up here in green and shaded is historic oil production rate. These are monthly average data, because that's what we get from the AOGCC. So this is not daily rates, but it is average for the month. And during BP's operatorship, they hit a max monthly oil production rate of 58,893, and that was in July of 1998. After that time, this was mostly Kuparuk light oil development for BP. They did do some Schrader Bluff development. You see declining rates. And at one point in time, BP decides they no longer want to be an owner of the Milne Point field, and they transition operatorship to Hillcorp in November of 2014. So that was when the field was, again, producing an average rate of just under 19,000 barrels of oil per day. During that time, Hillcorp has started up and increased the amount of infill drilling they've done in the field. They've implemented new technology such as polymer flooding in the Schrader Bluff, and they developed two new pads. In 2018, it was called Moose Pad, we now just call M Pad, and then this past year, Raven Pad, which we now just call R Pad. And what you see every year is continued production increases from that activity that they're doing. Along with that, they've also done facility expansion work on water handling, which is why we overlaid the blue line there. You can see during the BP era, your water handling was, and I'm just going to round here, around 130,000 barrels of water per day, and now under Hilcorp they've pushed that up towards 200,000 barrels of water per day. Because when you produce oil out of oil and gas fields, you get water, oil, and gas. There's no way to get around that. So you need to be able to handle all three fluids. So Hilcorp is doing whatever they can to maximize recovery out of the Milne Point unit.
Please proceed. Senator Stedman.
Just a point of clarification, Hank. It'd be nice to explain why some fields are water-constrained, why some fields are gas-constrained, and why we should even care.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, thanks for that question. All fields, in effect, when they're installed, have a certain amount of production capacity for oil, for water, and for gas. Most operators on the North Slope try to, you know, early days maximize oil production rates. You know, if you take a look at the very early days of Prudhoe Bay, when you hit your plateau rate, you know, in the 1.5-2 million barrel time frame, your oil production capacity was maxed out. They weren't making enough water or gas necessarily to maximize the equipment usage of that. But what ends up happening is as these fields mature, the amount of gas increases relative to the oil, and the amount of water increases relative to the oil. So your other production handling equipment becomes your constraint. So gas injection, compression turbines, whether it's or even well injection, and the same thing, water pumps might become your constraint, water injection wells might become your constraint. And so that will limit how much oil production you can get out of a field. In years past, we have provided this committee with the various facility constraints, both on oil, water, and gas that we have historically. And we've updated that for you if you'd like that for this season as well already. So we can send that to you if you'd like an update for this year.
Senator Stedman.
I think it would be, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be good information for the committee to get updated on, because I think back a decade or so ago, a little further than that, when we were having these production conversations, there was only one processing facility that wasn't maxed out. They couldn't process any more gas. They couldn't process any more water. The system was running wide open. And when we asked for those facilities to be listed out, I think there were 9 of them, or used to be, or some number, I'd have to go back and look, 9 or 12 or something. Anyway, there was only one that had excess capacity because they overbuilt. They were a little more optimistic than what the field actually produced, but it was a constraint that was not recognized in the building, and I think it's very important that we keep an eye on that, because if your facility is maxed out on gas or water, you can't produce anymore unless you back something out. And that would be helpful.
Commissioner Boyle, can you provide that to our office? And my office will disseminate to the members of the committee. Senator Stedman? Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you. For the record, Travis Peltier. We're going to move on here to status updates for key North Slope future projects. Again, this is just for the North Slope. There are actually 15 of them in total. We'll discuss that on a later slide. And there is one in the Cook Inlet as well, at the Cosmopolitan Onshore Oil Field. For this slide, however, we just wanted to focus on the North Slope. And the way these are listed for this year is chronologically when we expect them to come online. It just so happens the first three are most likely new pads within existing field developments. I'll discuss each one in detail in a second, but I just wanted to share that general characteristic. And the bottom three happen to be new units or massive expansions within existing units that require more facility infrastructure to be installed to make them work. So with that being said, let's talk about the Kuparuk River Unit Nunatoorok project. This is a new pad. Last year when we came to this committee and discussed what the status was, the ConocoPhillips, the operator of this unit, had funded the project and was doing construction activities. They had anticipated first oil to be 2025. Now that we're here in front of this committee, we've actually found that production startup happened in December of 2024. So ConocoPhillips was able to accelerate the activity and get it started up in the late December timeframe. We have our expectation for this production pad to deliver up to 20,000 barrels of new oil over the next few years out of the Kuparuk River units. So that's a good news story. We know we have it listed here as a key future project for the intent of the forecast. We'll talk about this on a later slide, but I want to address this now specifically. Anything not online as of June 30th, 2024, for our purposes, is considered a future project. When we get done with the forecast, it's still mid-November. So when we were done with the forecast, this project was still not yet online. So just for a reference. And then the next one is Mustang, which is both a new unit, a new facility, but it's a single pad. So that's the reason why I kind of refer to it as a single pad development. This, when we came here last year, the operator Finex had just taken over operatorship from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority as the unit operator in October of 2023. In the past year, Finex has done a lot of work to do pad expansion, pipeline tie-in, pad restart activities, and drilling two new additional development wells. And production has started up within the past month as well for this new unit as well. We expect, again, from our expectations for this unit to create up to 4,000 barrels of oil per day of sales out of the North Slope. Sorry. And then moving on to the Colville River Unit Minke project. In our project portfolio last year, this was not on our radar at all. So this was not testified to. And so for this year, in the past year, I should say, ConocoPhillips, the operator of the Colville River Unit, drilled an exploration well, CD5-32X. And within that, they were very excited about what they saw, and they've planned a producer-injector pair to be drilled this winter, early in 2025. And so in the future, we're going to continue to discuss this project, and the results of what our expectations will be, of course, is going to depend on the results of this initial producer-injector pair. But we should see something by the time we meet again a year from now on this. And now we're going to transition to the large, major, you know, billion-dollar-plus investments on the North Slope, what we have with PICA Phase 1. Last year when we came, this project operated by Santos was under development, under construction. First oil was anticipated in the second quarter of 2026. Fast forward 1 year later, construction has progressed significantly. Officially, production is still anticipated of 2026. However, in investor presentations, Santos has said they do have a high confidence they might be able to accelerate production to December of 2025. So there could be a new positive story for 2025 in here. However, we're still holding second quarter of 2026 as our baseline. The expectation on peak rate for that is 80,000 barrels a day, additional North Slope production just from this project. And then that transitions us to PICA Phase 2. We did have PICA Phase 2 in our project portfolio for last year, but we did not testify to it. So for this year, what we've seen is, you know, conceptual engineering, cost estimation, and schedule activities are ongoing for this. We anticipate that they will move into a front-end engineering design stage sometime this year, and then we'd look forward to a final investment decision sometime in 2027 from Santos. The peak rate for PICA Phase 2 is up to an additional 80,000 barrels a day of capacity installed within the PICA unit. So another large project within the brand new PICA unit that hopefully we'll see oil production from within the next 18 months. And that brings us to Willow, the final project on this list, operated by ConocoPhillips in Alaska. This is on federal lands in the National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska. Last year when we testified, the Bureau of Land Management had just had a record of decision released from their supplemental environmental impact statement, which was issued in 2023, and ConocoPhillips had started construction activities in April of 2023. ConocoPhillips also had a final investment decision announced in December of 2023 with first oil expected in 2029. 1 year later, project construction is still ongoing and first oil is still anticipated in 2029. A peak rate out of Willow is expected to be around 180,000 barrels of oil per day.
Senator Stedman.
Can you, Mr. Chairman, can we have them help us? Are all these 12 and an eighth or 16 or the royalty rate? And then does that, and where does that royalty go so we can get an idea of future opportunities at the table to help the citizens build a state?
Yeah, for the record, Derek Nottingham, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, not all of these are equal in their royalty share. The big ones that Travis just talked about, especially Willow. Willow is on the NPRA federal leases out to the, you know, the west of the main infrastructure at Prudhoe Bay, or on the North Slope. And those federal leases, in those situations, we don't collect a traditional 12.5% royalty. The federal government, I believe the royalty there is 16 2/3. The state receives a 50% share of that, and that goes back into the local communities. And so that is how I understand the Willow royalty gets kind of distributed back to the state. For PICA, a lot of PICA is on state land at a various royalty share, depending on the leases, between 16 2/3 to 12.5% in some. There's also a mix of native private land in the PICA unit, and so it's not a straightforward 12.5% royalty share there either. So you do get a kind of a mix of royalty shares on the PICA unit and the PICA development. Colville River is also a bit of federal land, so it's somewhat, I think, federal and private land, I believe. So there's a mix of royalty share there. When you get into Kuparik River, the Mustang Pad, those are more traditional 12.5% royalty, 16 2/3 royalty shares.
Mr. Stedman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think it would be nice if they got back to the committee or to the chairman on that, so we can factor that in when we have our conversation with revenue. Department of Revenue, and try to separate all this so we can get an idea of revenue.
And can you give a, while you're providing that, can you also give a snapshot of what 180,000 barrels per day will mean to, say, the communities in the field? I think there's only one, because I think it's important that we understand the magnitude of how much funds are going to be come available in the future to that one community, and give us the restrictions of what that those funds can be spent for. Senator Stedman? Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we're exploring the financials and their interaction with and effect on these projections, any of these developers pay the state's oil and gas corporate income tax, or are they all in that exempt category that Senator Stedman was talking about?
Mr. Nottingham.
Senator Keel, through the chair, Commissioner Boyle, for the record, I believe all the companies that we are talking about with these projects are structured in a way where they are paying corporate income tax or subject to paying corporate income tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to know there might be some other factors in whether we have decline or growth in the slope.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
For the record, Travis Peltier. We're going to transition now to the Cook Inlet. I know we've talked about the North Slope a fair amount, but the Cook Inlet's a very important basin for South Central and for Alaska as well. Just similar to the North Slope slide, we're going to talk about the highlights from production and the changes field by field from fiscal year 2024 versus fiscal year 2023. What we have again on the top right chart here is your annual average production out of the Cook Inlet field. I just want to highlight the axis on the left now. It only goes from 0 to 20,000 barrels of oil per day. The Cook Inlet Basin is a very mature basin. It's been producing for over 7 decades. It's had a very long production life from an oil perspective. And so the production rates we see here, you know, are very mature. What we have here, just from the chart data that we show, in 2018 being the peak year, just again for just this chart, is around 15,600 barrels per day. And over the past few fiscal years has declined all the way to fiscal year 2024 at just over 8,500 barrels of oil per day. If you compare fiscal year 24 to fiscal year 2023, that decline was 450 barrels of oil per day, or about 5%. Again, not out of line with the expectations you would have with such a mature basin and very mature fields. Just a reminder, the oil that we do get out of the Cook Inlet Basin is very important for in-state refinery usage. It helps us a lot, especially with transportation fuels such as aviation fuels that were used out of the Ted Stevens Airport, along with gasoline and other refined products. If we take a look at the field changes, again, I'll transition to speaking on the bottom chart. However, again, the bullets are going to match up. If we take a look at decreases in orange and then increases in blue, when we have Beaver Creek, Granite Point, the Hanson River, the MacArthur River, and Swanson River units, we have mostly natural decline being experienced. I do have Readout Shoal kind of in the middle there. Sorry about that. Readout Shoal did also have natural decline. However, there was some very good well work that was done to help offset that natural well decline that we saw last year. So some rate adding well work added a nice amount of additional oil back into the system that was lost from natural decline. And then two other fields, the Kenai Loop and the Middle Ground Shoal, are both effectively offline. That's why you see the Kenai Loop at a zero change year on year because it's producing nothing. And there was some maintenance work that made about 4 barrels on average for the whole year out of Middle Ground Shoal. So that's not really production. It's just a maintenance-type activity that yielded a production database note. And then we saw increases at Trading Bay and West MacArthur River. Again, these fields do experience natural decline year on year, and it was simply more than offset with some rate-adding well work at those fields. And again, just a reminder, if anyone is curious, they can go explore, you know, detailed field charts down to the well level with the link below.
Please proceed. In managing your time, we're a little over halfway. We have about 50 minutes left, so okay. Keep that in mind.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman, or Chair Hoffman, for that reminder. For that, then I might go more quickly through some of the forecasting methodology slides so that we can get to the heart of the forecast itself. I'll still speak to every slide, but I might not cover every bullet point, if that's okay?
That's fine.
Okay. So what do we include in the production forecast every year, then? I think it's important to note that when we take a look at the North Slope and the Cook Inlet, we take a look at forecasts for the current production, the current pools that are in existence. There's roughly 40 of them when we add them up across the North Slope, and then we treat the Cook Inlet mostly as a single basin for revenue purposes. We internally use all the pools, but we provide the Department of Revenue just a single data point for the Cook Inlet pools themselves. All of the information has to be publicly available by June 30th, 2024. All the fields have to be in production by June 30th, 2024 for them to be existing pools. If they're not, they're part of a future production wedge. One of the things that we do every year is we actually work with the Department of Revenue to have in-person and in-writing interviews with all of the operators of both the existing and future producing pools for both the North Slope and the Cook Inlet to have confidential information to understand risks and uncertainties of both future projects, existing pools, to get a sense of what we think the range of outcomes could be. So we do maintain that in confidential information as we go throughout this process. At the summary of all of those conversations, we did come up with 16 what we considered future projects in our portfolio for this year. 15, again, of those are located on the North Slope. One is located in the Cook Inlet. How we break this up, and I think I've addressed it slightly already, but we break this up into what we call current production. You'll see this in future slides as the acronym CP. This is, again, ongoing production from existing fields before or on June 30th of 2024. And the level of risk here, you know, is significantly lower for existing fields, but we do take into account that, you know, well and facility uptime expectations, ensuring that operators are continuing to reinvest in their base production, and if there are any changes to how they manage their reservoirs to see if we're going to have any production changes that we anticipate. The next two are future development activities. So we call them under development and under evaluation. These all require new investments, you know, for anywhere from tens of millions to hundreds of millions to billions of dollars. The rate contribution on these are not necessarily certain. They're not all in existing fields. So there's a higher level of uncertainty in terms of what we're going to get. One category for under development this year is solely infill drilling within existing fields. So we treat that with a certain level of risk. And then all of the projects and infill drilling years 2 through 10 have yet another level of risk and put on top of that. For the large projects, there's always time uncertainty as well. So we're never sure if a field or if a like a new unit like a project like Willow, we've seen that coming on in 2029. But could they accelerate it? Could it be earlier? Might it slip? Could it be later? There's always uncertainty in terms of timing on that, along with commercial risks, other economic risks. So we weigh all those every year when we put our forecasts together and add that additional uncertainty into our forecasts. I think on this slide, I know we've talked a little bit already, so I'm not going to go through field by field. I'll perhaps save time on this one, but there is in the National Petroleum Reserve federal property. We do have the Big Willow development there. As Director Nottingham did mention, within the Colville River unit, it's mixed acreage between state, federal, and private leases that does span the border from National Petroleum Reserve of Alaska onto state lands. There are a large number of projects purely on state lands, which is great news. And then even on the east, we have the Point Thompson unit in Sourdough, some additional projects we considered all on state lands as well. And the one not listed on here for the Cook Inlet, because it's too much to put on a single map, is the onshore oil field for Cosmopolitan is the other project that we included in this as well for 2024. Okay. So let's take a look at the production forecast results in summary. So this is the same chart we had the preview of earlier. So I'd like to hit on some of the short-term and long-term key points that we have here. For the fiscal year 2025, annualized average daily statewide production is expected to be 474,000 barrels of oil per day. The North Slope contribution to that is 466,000 barrels of oil per day. In the range of uncertainty, you know, low to high case is 424,000 barrels to up to 510,000 barrels of oil per day. You can see this year that the operator forecast is different. You know, in years past, we've actually had a very close proximity to the operator forecast with the official. This year, the operator's forecast is higher than ours. Of course, we'd like to see that happen, and I'd like to be wrong in this case, but, you know, we'll see what happens in the fullness of time. For the long term, we do see the official forecast trending upwards. As Commissioner Boyle has already talked about, a number of large projects we expect to come on. One of the things to kind of remember, again, these are snapshots in time. So this fall of 2024 forecast, you know, we settled on the ink on just before Thanksgiving. So if there's been any major changes to North Slope, you know, business plans, assumption sets, they will have to be taken into account in a future production forecast.
Please proceed. Senator Stedman.
Just a real quick one for information. Tell the committee or remind the committee how that interaction goes and how often a year do you sit down with the industry for their forward projections out of the next 3 to 5 years in capital expenditures.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, thanks for that question. We sit down with the operators twice a year. So we do it once in the fall, kind of in the October time frame. We talk with every operator and get a good sense of what their business plans are, investment plans are. Again, these are all confidential conversations that we have with them. And then again, for the spring, we do it for an update during session. We're actually going to be having those conversations again in early February to verify where we're at with any changes to business plans. So when we issue the spring update, we'll be done with that by March 1st, at least on the oil production forecasting side. It's going to take, you know, Department of Revenue a couple of weeks to get that matriculated through, but we'll have those conversations in early February.
Senator Stedman?
No, that's it.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Okay. So I think one question to ask, and we've heard it from this committee before, is how are we doing? You know, we just published a production forecast in the fall of 2024. Again, we kind of put our pencils down mid-November. So how's it look? That's exactly what this chart is meant to entail. So again, oil production is on the left. Cumulative production is on the right. What you see for the top two line charts is the fall of 2024 forecast now. For all of fiscal year 2025 and the first half of fiscal year 2026, this way you can kind of see the monthly variations from the summer turnaround season all the way through the high winter rates. And then again, as the North Slope heats up and those facility maintenance activities start to occur again, you see that production decrease in the summer there of 2025. What you again have overlaid here is the actual daily North Slope production out of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. And at the date that we had the latest point of data for this presentation, which was January the 20th, our forecast versus actuals, the actuals were 100% 0.2. So slightly over, but I'd say that's within the noise. But at least we're happy to say that we're still on trend for, you know, actual production matching what our forecast is.
Please proceed.
Okay, and so I think this is the final slide with charts. And what we have here for the fall of 2024 is the Alaska statewide annualized forecast with the expected case with the production categories listed. So when we take a look at the chart on the top left, again, it's fiscal year annualized average daily oil production rate, 0 to 700,000 barrels of oil this time. Fiscal year is going from 2025 to 2034. This will be the same on both charts. What we have here is the current production out of existing pools, again, as of June 30th, 2024, highlighted in blue. We have the next 12 months of infill drilling in the orange wedge there, so we see that play out through time along with the production decline from that. And then the next 9 years after that of infill drilling in existing pools, plus the 16 projects of oil production that we expect building up at the wedge. If we focus on the chart on the right, which is just those expected future production projects, and we take a look at the spring 2024 forecast, we can kind of see a difference here of what we expect out of the future projects. The near to midterm is relatively similar, but when you started talking about Pikka Phase 2 and Willow, there was an increased confidence from the members of the team who do the project risk assessment sessions. And so what you see is a production rate increase as we have increased confidence that those projects are going to come on and the rates are going to be, you know, what we expect as associated with that. Along with that, there is, you know, again, one of the risks we assume is on time frame, right? So one thing you might have seen in years past is, you know, say I'm going to pick on Willow just because it's on the slide here for a second. You know, it's anticipated first oil is 2029. But it might be a year earlier, it could be 2 or 3 years later, as just an uncertainty. And so as these projects all get closer, you know, to actually being online, that range of uncertainty in terms of project delivery shrinks, and we actually see increased production rate out of that as well.
But given the politics back east in Washington, this does not reflect any changes that may result in lower regulations, and we could potentially see even better forecasts as a result of what's happening in Washington in the next 10 years.
Chair Hoffman, I think the way I would respond to that is you're correct in the first statement. This does not reflect changes out of Washington, D.C. For the second half of that, I'm a bit conservative being an engineer, so I'd like to wait and see. I don't know if we'll have changes for you in the spring of 2025. However, I think it will be much more clear in the fall of 2025 what changes will be occurring on the North Slope due to the administration change.
Thank you. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Peltier, in producing these forecasts, you're aggregating everything from the reserves to the project execution to it requires anticipating a lot when you get into the realm of the project delivery that has to happen in order to develop reserves, and hopefully it's as proved. Is there any substantive improvement in the process of aggregating all that information? We have a short-term trend that shows that here that we're on track pretty well for how we estimate the delivery. Do you see improvements on the horizon, or has there been anything that is driving improvement other than you mentioned there was a correction factor of 1% that was a little off. Do you see anything on the horizon that drives greater accuracy in these estimates?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, thanks for that question. I think I'll say at a high level every year when we get done with the production forecast, in the spring time frame, the entire team, the core team that puts this together, we all sit down and try to tear it apart and figure out ways with which we can make it better. So we've been doing that for the past 3 years, and every year we always kind of make some incremental changes that we think improve the calculations. Going forward into this year, I can't anticipate what those would be yet, right? We're kind of in the middle of put out the forecast, get ready to come here and testify, get ready to do the spring forecast. So I don't know what we're going to have that discussion is going to focus on come April, but we will have that discussion as we do every year.
Okay.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I'm just verifying I covered all my bullet points for this. So, okay. I'm going to move on to the production summary table. I know we're getting our summary slide. This is the final content slide. So just to summarize what we've already discussed, you know, we in the Department of Natural Resources use the best available information that we have year on year to generate as near and accurate a forecast as we can for your purposes. This is updated annually in the fall and in the spring to incorporate the latest plans from operators. And, you know, the Department of Revenue also updates their price outlook with each forecast. This year, our mean annual production is from 475 to 500,000 barrels in the first few years of the outlook period and does increase towards the middle and end to 660,000 barrels of oil per day based off the current snapshot of operator plans. And again, just a reminder, you know, for all of the production estimates that we put out, you know, the projects under evaluation account for several considerations, several risks, several uncertainties, you know, technically, commercially, and just from project execution. So, and with that, I did want to thank the team that puts this together and to thank this committee for allowing us to come and testify. So thank you on behalf of the entire production forecasting team for the opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner, for that presentation. Do we have any final questions of the team?
Thank you, Mr. Coger. For the Commissioner, you know, you see a lot in the news right now about the executive orders being reversed. So when President Biden did his executive orders, all those things were in place. And now what President Trump has done is just went back to that. And I just want to reassure the public that we're not going to expect anything less than the best of the safest, most, you know, cleanest resource development in the world. We're not lessening our standards. I guess so if you could just highlight that real quick, that we are not expecting anything less. If we're going to do development, it's going to be the best of the best. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cronk, for that question. Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Cronk, Commissioner Boyle, for the record. That's correct. As far as state permitting processes, you know, nothing changes. We're going to continue to have everything in place that ensures that we're looking out for clean air, clean water, healthy wildlife populations, and the like. I think a lot of the restrictions that we saw coming from the Biden administration really just weren't focused around permitting. They were focused around just setting areas aside, saying, for one reason or another, we're just not going to allow this type of activity to occur in this area. And so, to me, restoring that balance to say, no, we don't need to take areas off the table. We can evaluate projects that may be feasible in those areas. They will undergo a robust permitting process to evaluate what risks there may or may not be associated with them, and then, you know, appropriately mitigated or avoided in order to move forward. So I think it's really just about giving every project a fair shake and not making these kind of predeterminational decisions of we're just not going to allow this or contemplate this at all for one reason or the next. So I think, you know, that shift will result in increased interest and activity because there's frankly just more area available for potential development.
Thank you, Senator Cronk. Senator Stedman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'd like to thank the department for kind of mixing up the charts this year, like chart number 18. It's a little different layout. I think that's well represented. It's appreciated that you guys have taken the effort to try to make the information, you know, continually more understandable as we bring it in and we mix up our members and so on and so forth. It is appreciated, and I just wanted to let you know. And I did take note, Mr. Pelletier, enjoyed coming back to Senate Finance, so we'll have to invite the team back again sometime.
We'll do that. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Any additional comments or questions from committee members? With that, I'd like to thank Commissioner Boyle for his presentation and his team. It's always been a joy to listen to the commissioner and the department on their professionalism. That concludes the work of today's agenda. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Friday, January 24th at 9 a.m. We're going to be hearing from the Department of Revenue and their forecast. So we'll see everyone there. We stand adjourned.